In a world obsessed with external achievements and material success, Jiddu Krishnamurti's What Are You Doing With Your Life stands as a profound counterpoint. Time magazine named him one of the five saints of the 20th century, yet Krishnamurti rejected all spiritual authority, including his own. Born in India in 1895 and educated in England, he spent 65 years traveling the world with a revolutionary message. True freedom comes only through self-knowledge, not through following others. Steve Jobs reportedly kept Krishnamurti's books on his iPad, while figures like Aldous Huxley and David Bohm considered him a transformative thinker. Unlike most spiritual teachers, Krishnamurti established no formal practice or path, insisting instead that truth is a pathless land. His foundations and schools worldwide continue his legacy of encouraging people to question everything, especially their own thinking, rather than accepting prepackaged answers. As we navigate an increasingly complex and fractured world, his invitation to radical self-inquiry has never been more relevant. What are you? This seemingly simple question lies at the heart of Krishnamurti's teachings. The mind, our only instrument for thinking and acting, remains largely unexamined by most of us. It is the result of centuries of conditioning. Climate, tradition, culture, social and economic influences, and religious programming. This conditioning creates a divided consciousness, the superficial and the hidden, the conscious and unconscious, all of which constitute what we call the self. This self encompasses our ideas, memories, conclusions, experiences, intentions, conscious endeavors, accumulated unconscious memories, and all projections, whether in action or as virtue. It includes our competitive nature and desire to be something. Fundamentally, this self is divisive, what Krishnamurti calls an evil thing because it separates and isolates through its self-enclosing activities. Yet we also experience extraordinary moments when the self disappears, when there is no sense of effort or striving. These moments occur when there is love. They reveal a possibility beyond the self's constant activity. Understanding oneself doesn't mean withdrawal from relationship. Self-knowledge is a process, not an end. We discover ourselves not in isolation, but in relationship to society, to others, to ideas. This discovery requires extraordinary alertness of mind to observe our reactions in the midst of relationship. The confusion and misery in the world wasn't created by political systems, but by our relationship with each other. What we are within is projected outward. If we are confused and chaotic within, that becomes the world. Our relationship with others constitutes society, and if our relationships are confused and limited, we project chaos into the world. Revolution cannot occur unless we understand ourselves as a total process. We aren't isolated individuals, but results of the whole human struggle with its illusions and conflicts. Understanding oneself leads to immediate inner revolution. Self-knowledge comes through relationship, not isolation. Without knowing yourself, there is no basis for right thought or transformation. The more we analyze a problem, the more complex it becomes. We must see it comprehensively, as a whole, which is only possible when thinking, rooted in the conditioned self, comes to an end. Can we observe the self without analyzing, just seeing its activity without trying to destroy or encourage it? If the center of the me ceased to exist, our problems would end. This requires awareness beyond thought. As long as mental activity persists, there can be no love. In this restless world, most of us seek happiness and peace, some refuge from turmoil and strife. We move from one leader, organization, or teacher to another in this pursuit. But are we seeking happiness itself or gratification that we hope will bring happiness? There's a crucial difference. Happiness is derivative, a byproduct, while gratification is what most of us actually pursue. Most people define happiness as getting what they want, whether possessions, achievements, or success. As long as desires are fulfilled, we feel happy. When thwarted, unhappiness begins. But the moment we become conscious that we're happy, it ceases to be happiness. Like humility, true happiness cannot be pursued. It comes unbidden. We don't truly enjoy things, but are merely superficially amused or excited by sensations we call joy. In youth, we delight in simple things, but as we age, we seek different sensations: power, position, lust. When we see something beautiful, we want to possess it. In this process of holding, we create dependence and fear, losing the very joy and beauty we sought to capture. We move from refinement to refinement, enjoyment to enjoyment, but at the center remains the me that wants more happiness. Only when the me in all its subtle forms comes to an end can there be a state of bliss that cannot be sought after, an ecstasy and joy without corruption. Our current happiness contains corruption, because behind it lies pain and fear. We desire security, which is understandable when facing physical danger. But psychological security doesn't exist at any level with anybody. We remain isolated despite relationships, yet we desperately seek security through marriage, vows, and other self-deceptions. We avoid confronting our fundamental insecurity. When feeling completely insecure, we run away or become unbalanced. To truly realize the fact of insecurity requires an extraordinarily simple, clear, harmonious living. We seek endlessly without questioning why. We seek because we're dissatisfied, unhappy, lonely, fearful. We need something to cling to, someone to protect us. The first step is to stop seeking altogether and instead question what drives this search. Our deep dissatisfaction creates a gnawing discontent that can be temporarily satisfied with jobs, possessions, or ideological success. Training the intellect doesn't create intelligence. Intelligence emerges when one acts in perfect harmony, both intellectually and emotionally. Intellect is thought functioning independently of emotion, while intelligence integrates both feeling and reasoning capacities intensely and harmoniously. Modern education develops intellect, offering theories and explanations without affection. Our cunning minds become satisfied with explanations, but intelligence requires complete unity of mind and heart in action. Only approaching life with intelligence rather than mere intellect can free humanity from ceaseless toil. All thinking is conditioned by our background, culture, and environment. There's no such thing as free thinking, but perhaps through awareness, not through willful determination, which creates conflict, we can uncondition the mind. Simply being aware of our conditioning, without conflict, may burn away our problems. Understanding flashes when the mind is quiet, when thought is absent, when verbalization stops. A still mind cannot be cultivated. A cultivated stillness creates only a dead mind. The more interested you are in something, the clearer and freer your mind becomes. Don't try to analyze your thoughts and emotions. Become intensely aware of them as they function. Discover the motive behind your thinking. The must and must not approach has crippled your thought and feeling. This doesn't mean licentiousness, but freedom from compulsion. To free the mind from conditioning, see its totality without thought. Can you look without bringing in the process of reaction? Can you simply be aware that you're a Hindu, socialist, communist, or whatever, without judging it as right or wrong? This awareness of your total being without reaction is what dissolves conditioning, the freedom from self. Ignorance is not knowing the ways of the self. This ignorance can only be dispelled through constant awareness of the self's movements in all relationships. We aren't merely conditioned by environment, we are the environment. We don't see that we are the total environment because multiple entities within us revolve around the me. The self is made of desires in various forms, creating a central figure, the thinker, the will of me and mine. This establishes division between self and not self, between me and society, beginning all conflict. knowledge isn't wisdom or intelligence. Wisdom can't be bought, found in books, accumulated, or stored. It comes with self-abnegation and an open mind, not through information, but through observing our thoughts, feelings, and relationships. Intelligence exceeds intellect by integrating reason and love, arising only through self-knowledge. Only when fully aware of the self's contradictory desires can we go beyond it. Only love and right thinking bring true revolution, the revolution within ourselves. Ignorance is not knowing the ways of the self. This ignorance can only be dispelled through constant awareness of the self's movements in all relationships. We aren't merely conditioned by environment, we are the environment. We don't see that we are the total environment because multiple entities within us revolve around the me. The self is made of desires in various forms, creating a central figure, the thinker, the will of me and mine. This establishes division between self and not self, between me and society, beginning all conflict. Knowledge isn't wisdom or intelligence. Wisdom can't be bought, found in books, accumulated, or stored. It comes with self-abnegation and an open mind, not through information, but through observing our thoughts, feelings, and relationships. Intelligence exceeds intellect by integrating reason and love, arising only through self-knowledge. Only when fully aware of the self's contradictory desires can we go beyond it. Only love and right thinking bring true revolution, the revolution within ourselves. As technology creates more leisure time, we face three possibilities: using it for entertainment, including religious activities, destructive purposes, or turning inward to question established values and discover what lies beyond the brain's products. Many are revolting against society through drugs and withdrawal, but any form of stimulant, whether drugs, drink, sex, or even emotional religious experiences, ultimately dulls the mind by creating dependency. We seek to identify with something larger because our conflicts and ambitions feel small and petty. Some identify with God, the state, or utopian visions. Some forget themselves in material things, while others use spiritual practices. Both the materialistic and spiritual share the same intention, escaping a self that feels insubstantial. Our desire for sensation makes us cling to music and beauty. Dependence on external forms reveals our inner emptiness, which we cover with sensations. We fear seeing what we truly are. Sensations have beginnings and ends, can be repeated and expanded, causing conflict and misery. True experiencing, which is different from repeating experiences, has no continuity. Only in genuine experiencing is there renewal and transformation. Sex becomes a problem because in that act there's complete absence of self-consciousness, a moment of happiness where the me ceases. Desiring more of this self-abnegation and complete happiness, it becomes all-important. Everywhere else, in our relationships with property, people, ideas, we experience conflict and self-consciousness. Sex offers momentary freedom from the self, while all else leads to misery and turmoil. The real problem isn't sex, but how to be free from the self. Why shouldn't one have pleasure? Seeing a beautiful sunset, a lovely tree, a river with its wide curve, or a beautiful face gives great delight. The confusion and misery begin when that moment becomes memory, demanding greater continuity of pleasure. We want such things repeated. Whether sexual, artistic, or intellectual, we crave repetition, which darkens the mind and creates false values. Understanding pleasure is essential. If life is only pleasure, with it come misery, confusion, and illusions. To understand pleasure is not to deny it. Pleasure is a basic demand of life, like enjoyment. But we must see how thought transforms natural delight into craving for more. There are two kinds of emptiness: the emptiness the mind labels as such, and real emptiness. We try to escape the feeling of loneliness, isolation, and being cut off through knowledge, relationships, or the demand for perfect union. Most of us, being empty, fill ourselves with noise, pleasure, and every form of escape. A cup or room is useful when empty, but we crowd ourselves with furniture of distraction. To understand the self, which alone can bring about radical revolution and regeneration, there must be intention to understand its whole process. The process of the individual is not opposed to the world or the mass. You are the mass. We want transformation because what we are dissatisfies us. It creates conflict and disturbance. Disliking that state, we want something better, something nobler, more idealistic. When you radically change, you're not changing for society or to reach heaven. You change because it's necessary for itself. When you love something for itself, it brings tremendous clarity, and this clarity brings salvation to humanity, not good works and reforms. Arguments and explanations don't lead to direct action, because fundamental change needs no formula or outside influence. We need to change not according to any particular idea, as ideas about action prevent actual action. Between action and idea lies a time interval where resistance, conformity, or imitation occur. Outward changes force conformity to patterns, but meeting life's challenges requires deep revolution. We waste energy through resistance, conformity, and obedience. To conserve energy for transformation, we must become aware of our indolence and gather all energy for a radical revolution in consciousness itself, creating a new mind that sees life differently. The significance of life is living itself. We don't truly live when following others through fear and authority. Life's meaning can only emerge when we put away authority and understand how our minds create it. Life encompasses everyday actions, thoughts, feelings, struggles, and relationships, not abstract concepts. We seek purpose because we don't understand our everyday existence, with its anxieties and fears. Life encompasses everyday actions, thoughts, feelings, struggles, anxieties, and routines, not just one layer of consciousness, but our total relationship to things, people, and ideas. We seek purpose because we don't understand our everyday existence. If we understood how to live, living itself would be sufficient. To grasp living's full significance, we must understand our complex life's daily tortures without escaping. Each of us must understand the society we live in, not through philosophers or teachers, and transform our way of living completely. We ask about life's meaning because our lives feel empty, monotonous, and meaningless. A person living richly, seeing things as they are, doesn't ask this question. For them, living itself is the beginning and end. When we seek purpose with an empty heart, that purpose will also be empty. Reality can only be understood through living, not escaping. Life is relationship and action within relationship. When relationship is confused, we seek meaning elsewhere. Understanding our relationships brings its own reward. Love cannot be cultivated outside relationship. It exists within it. When there is love, which is its own eternity, there's no need to search for God, because love is God. We carry both external and internal fears. Externally, we fear losing jobs, not having enough food, losing position, or mistreatment from others. Internally, we fear not becoming successful, death, loneliness, not being loved, and the emptiness of boredom. These fears pervade our existence and shape our responses to life. Our essential problem is freedom from fear. Fear darkens and dulls the mind, breeds violence, and leads to worship of external things. It prevents psychological freedom and limits our capacity to understand ourselves and the world. Much of our brain structure is inherited from animals. Like animals, humans are violent, greedy, comfort-seeking, competitive, and function in social groups. Physical fear is part of this animal heritage, a natural response for self-preservation. The question becomes, can we free ourselves not only from our animal inheritance, but also from the conditioning of our society and culture? To discover something of a totally different dimension, we must first achieve freedom from fear. Self-protective reactions aren't fear, but intelligence. Everyone needs food, clothes, and shelter, basic human requirements that transcend political divisions. Nationalism and religious beliefs have divided humanity, setting people against each other. We cling to our little territories while failing to address our common needs. Fear arises through thought about the future or past, fear of tomorrow, of death, of illness. Fear always exists in relation to something, and thought creates this relationship. Thought breeds fear by projecting into time. Thought breeds both fear and pleasure. Thinking about past pain creates fear of its return. Thinking about past pleasure increases desire for more. Thought is necessary in certain domains, at work, when speaking or writing, but is thought necessary in other areas of life? Our thought is the response of memory accumulated through experience, knowledge, and tradition. When we give complete attention to anything, there is no observer, no thinker, no center from which we're observing. In complete attention, the self-centered thought process temporarily ceases. Total attention eliminates the observer, the center of thought that breeds fear. The observer is the me, the self, the ego, the sensor. When thought stops, there is no observer. Dependence on things, people, or ideas breeds fear. This dependence arises from ignorance, lack of self-knowledge, and inner poverty. Fear prevents clear understanding and communication. Through self-awareness, we can discover both superficial and deep causal fears. The self is the root of all fear, the past constantly giving birth to the present, becoming the identifying memory of me and mine. Are we ever truly related to anyone, or is our relationship merely between two images we've created about each other? I have an image about you, and you have an image about me. The relationship exists between these two images and nothing else. True relationship is only possible when there is no image. When I can look at you without the memory of insults and past experiences, only then is there direct contact. This requires great attention and awareness, to look at another without the filter of my memories of that person. Only when there are no images between two people is there authentic relationship. For most of us, relationship is based on dependency, economic or psychological. This dependence creates fear, possessiveness, friction, suspicion, and frustration. While economic dependence might be addressed through legislation, psychological dependence stems from craving personal satisfaction and happiness. In this possessive relationship, we feel enriched and more complete through another, and fear losing this source of completeness. This fear often hides behind pleasant words. The reaction to this fear drives us to seek security through various channels or to isolate ourselves. The complex problem is how to love without dependence, without conflict, without withdrawing when challenges arise. Though intellectually we understand life is constant change, emotionally we cling to comforting values, creating an ongoing battle between change and the desire for permanency. Can one love without possessing? The answer lies not in escape or ideals, but in deeply understanding the causes of dependence and possessiveness. If we can truly understand this problem of relationship between oneself and another, we might solve our relationship with society, which is merely an extension of ourselves. Society is created by past generations. We accept it because it maintains our greed, possessiveness, and illusion. In this illusion, unity and peace cannot exist. Mere economic unity through compulsion won't end war. Without understanding individual relationships, we cannot have a peaceful society. Since our relationships are based on possessive love, we must become deeply aware of its birth, causes, and actions. This complete understanding frees thought from dependence and possessiveness. Harmony in relationship must be found within oneself, not in another or the environment. In relationship, the primary cause of friction is oneself, the self that is the center of unified craving. If we realize that what matters is not how another acts, but how we act and react, and if those reactions can be deeply understood, relationship will undergo radical change. One can be harmonious with another only when harmonious within oneself. In relationship, the important thing is not the other, but understanding deeply in oneself the cause of conflict and sorrow. Dependence on another for psychological well-being inevitably creates fear from which arises sorrow. Relationship is the mirror in which you discover yourself. Without relationship, you are not. To be is to be related. To be related, existence. You exist only in relationship. Otherwise, existence has no meaning. You don't exist because you think you do. You exist because you are related, and conflict comes from not understanding relationship. Where there is attachment, love cannot exist, and where there is dependency, fear arises. This refers to psychological dependency on ideas, people, or property, not practical dependencies like needing the milkman for milk or relying on railways or bridges. Love cannot be cultivated. It's not something the mind can purchase. Saying, "I will practice being compassionate," makes compassion a mental construct, not love. Love emerges unknowingly, fully, when we understand the entire process of relationship. When the mind becomes quiet and doesn't fill the heart with its own creations, then love can naturally arise. Is the problem of sex about the act itself or our thoughts about it? The sexual act is no more problematic than eating, but thinking about it constantly creates the problem. Media, entertainment, and culture constantly build up thoughts of sex. Why does the mind focus on it? Because it offers a rare moment of self-forgetfulness, perhaps the only complete escape from self-awareness. Everything else in life, business, religion, politics, social activities, emphasizes the me, the self. Sex becomes the only avenue to momentary happiness through forgetting yourself. Sex becomes complex only when you don't understand the mind that obsesses over it. Why do we turn everything we touch into a problem? Why do we submit to living with problems rather than ending them? Why not die to our problems instead of carrying them day after day, year after year? Sex is relevant, but the primary question is, why do we make life itself problematic? Is it because we always think from a fixed point of view? Desire is not love. Desire seeks pleasure and creates conflict. I'm not advocating the elimination of desire. That would be impossible, despite what ascetics have attempted through self-torture. Rather, we must understand desire's nature and its relationship to pleasure and pain. Beyond this understanding lies a bliss and ecstasy that is love, something that transcends mere gratification. The family is like one room in a vast house of human existence. When we forget the whole house, we make that single room disproportionately important. We cling to our separate family units, battling endlessly with others, forgetting our connection to humanity. Family only has meaning in relation to the whole of human existence, otherwise it becomes monstrous in its exclusivity. We don't truly love our children. They become habits, amusements, toys. True caring is like tending a newly planted tree, digging deep, ensuring the right soil, protecting and watching it daily as part of your being. If we loved our children this way, we would create a different education, eliminate war and poverty, and move beyond competition and nationality. Our failure to love has allowed these destructive patterns to flourish. True meditation isn't repeating mantras or sitting in special postures. These make the mind dull. Meditation is attending to everything, how you speak to your family, servants, boss. It's not concentration, which is exclusion and resistance. Concentration creates distraction. With attention, you can observe every thought and movement without distraction, and then you can truly meditate. Meditation brings clarity. It is silence, and that silence becomes the natural disciplining process of life, not forcing yourself into silence. When you're attentive to every word, gesture, feeling, and motive without correction, silence emerges, and from that comes effortless discipline. This movement exists outside of time. Such a person lives joyously, creating neither enmity nor unhappiness. Truth cannot be given to you. You must discover it yourself. To find it, you must be your own law, your own guide, not following politicians, leaders, priests, or books. You must stand completely alone inwardly, without fear. Understanding the nature of fear, death, and love isn't theoretical, but lived experience. This whole process of understanding life and freeing yourself from battles immediately, giving complete attention to it, that is meditation, not sitting in corners repeating silly words. Without self-knowledge, there is no meditation. Being fully aware of all your responses and daily activities is essential. Merely locking yourself away to meditate before an image is escape. Without self-knowledge, there is no right thinking, and without right thinking, your actions have no meaning. When there is self-knowledge, right thinking emerges, leading to right action. Meditation means emptying the mind of the past, not as an ideology practiced daily, but truly emptying it through deep awareness. Being aware of your conditioning, your way of talking, gestures, callousness, brutality, and violence without condemning them leads to a completely quiet mind. To understand this quietness, you must understand sorrow, which follows most of us like a shadow. In sorrow, there is self-pity, concern with one's loneliness and emptiness. Without addressing sorrow, there can be no stillness of mind. Stillness of mind comes with beauty and love, not mere ornament or good taste. Beauty exists when you know love, which requires intelligence, austerity, and order. No authority can give this to you. You must understand your daily life structure, your thoughts, motives, behavior, conditioning. Begin with transforming your daily existence completely. Only the still mind can discover truth, because it has no imagination or projected desires. In that stillness lies the bliss of something beyond words. A still mind isn't a disciplined mind, but one that's free through understanding. This still mind can know creation. A truly still mind is tremendously active. Anything moving at the highest speed appears quiet. Only dull minds worry and feel anxious. Only the still mind is a religious mind that can discover the state of creation. Such a mind brings peace to the world, not politicians or business people. Peace is your responsibility, reflected in how you live daily. If you want peace, live peacefully without hatred, envy, power-seeking, or competition. From freedom from these comes love, and only a mind capable of loving knows peaceful living.